Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Thursday, the 2nd of July. Today, Britain's largest rail contract, the East Coast Route, is nationalised, leaving the government's franchise policy in doubt and a hole in its transport budget.
National Express said, look, over the past 6 months alone, we've lost £20 million on it. We're not getting the passenger numbers, we're not getting the fare revenues, and it's just it's a loss-making burden that we're going to have to take off our shoulders.
A setback for Tony Blair's ambitions to become President of Europe.
Basically, everybody's waiting for the Irish to vote in their second referendum at the beginning of October. In Brussels speak, the Irish got it wrong the first time and they better get it right this time.
And 40 years after humans first walked on the moon, we talked to science writer Chris Riley about the legacy of Apollo 11.
Apollo 11 was something of galactic significance, and that's very rare that human beings do anything of galactic significance.
But first, here's Bill Overton with the news and today's papers.
In the early hours of the morning, thousands of American troops moved into Helmand province in southern Afghanistan in a new assault on the Taliban. The operation, named Strike of the Sword, involved 4,000 US troops and 650 Afghan forces, backed up by about 50 aircraft. A week ago, British forces conducted a similar push, the goal being to clear the area of insurgents before the presidential election in August. Amnesty International is accusing both Israel and Hamas of war crimes in the invasion of Gaza earlier in the year. In a report on the two-week war, the campaign group says Israeli forces recklessly used artillery and white phosphorus in densely populated areas. The report also says Hamas was guilty of indiscriminate rocket fire against Israeli civilians. Michael Jackson's body will not, after all, go on public display at his Neverland Ranch. The Jackson family made the announcement through their PR firm, saying they're still trying to organise a public memorial service. The singer's will has finally been filed at a Los Angeles court. He gives all his estate to a family trust for his three children and 79-year-old mother. Diana Ross is named as guardian if something happens to his mother. With a sharp rise in sales of his music, it's expected their legacy will be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Banks and credit card companies are to be banned from sending out blank checks to customers. It'll be announced in a consumer white paper later. The government is concerned the checks draw people into more debt. At Wimbledon, the man to play Andy Murray in the semi-final also had to go through a five-set marathon into yesterday evening. Former finalist Andy Roddick finally defeated former winner Leighton Hewitt after a tough tussle that the winner called a dogfight. Andy Murray and Michael Jackson share the front pages of the morning papers once again. Into the cauldron, Murray through to semis as expectations build, writes The Guardian. The Independent pictures his girlfriend Kim Sears, while The Telegraph and Mail feature film actress Kate Winslet, who was there in the celebrity box. Titanic effort, Andy, is the Mail's caption. The paper writes it was no sweat for Andy and his centre court faithful as he beat Ferrero. But the Times warns fans forced to dig deep as Murray mania grips Wimbledon, reporting tickets for the men's final are being offered for sale online at an astonishing £20,000. The Red Tops give their lead over to Michael Jackson, his will and his funeral. They're surprised his will reads, "Give my children to Diana Ross and absolutely nothing to my ex-wife," as the Mirror puts it. The other main story shared by three broadsheet papers is the future for transport with the failure of National Express's East Coast franchise. The Times says passengers face years of overcrowded trains and dilapidated rolling stock because of a deepening hole in the rail budget. The Guardian has seen a leaked document from the Transport Department that warns of looming spending cuts and the delay or cancellation of a series of schemes for both road and rail building. Read more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Britain's largest rail franchise, the London to Edinburgh East Coast route, is being nationalised. National Express says it can no longer afford the £1.4 billion contract. The Transport Secretary, Lord Adonis, says the contract will be put up back for auction. But it's unlikely to raise £1.4 billion, and that leaves taxpayers footing the bill. Our transport correspondent is Dan Milmo.
National Express had agreed to pay the government £1.4 billion over a 7.5-year contract. That's a lot of money in quite a short space of time. We're around about 2 years into the contract, and yesterday National Express said, look, over the past 6 months alone, we've lost £20 million on it. We're not getting the passenger numbers, we're not getting the fare revenues, and it's just it's a loss-making burden that we're going to have to take off our shoulders.
Will National Express lose other rail franchises that it currently holds?
Well, this is going to be the subject of, from our position, quite a tasty legal row, it seems. National Express is quite adamant, for a relatively arcane legal argument that it does not have to give up its other two rail franchises, which are C2C and National Express East Anglia, which basically carry commuters from Norfolk and Essex into London. The government, however, says, hang on, we've got guidelines that say if you lose one franchise, East Coast, you lose them all. And it seems like this is going to have to be settled by a court hearing.
How serious a blow is this to the government's franchise policy? Because this is the second time in 3 years that the owner of the East Coast contract has had to walk away from it.
It certainly shows that there's a problem in the bidding process. What happened last time round, just to remind people, is GNER bid $1.3 billion for the contract and handed it back a year later. What they handed back was the contract. They didn't hand back the £1.3 billion that they pledged. National Express, a little more than a year later, pledged £1.4 billion for the contract. Yesterday, all it has handed back is around about £70 million. The other £1.3 billion, it's not having to hand back at all. It's contractually not obliged to do that. So that leaves a bit of a problem. Every time these franchises are announced, the government says, this company says it will pay $1 billion plus to the Department for Transport over the next, say, 10 years. Well, we've now seen in two sequential contract failures that that is not the case. They're not beholden to those contracts in that way at all.
What effect will this have on passengers?
Passengers will be fine. In fact, if National Express and Lord Adonis, the Transport Secretary, agreed on one thing yesterday, and it wasn't much they agreed on, it was that services will not be affected. Services will not be cut. Nothing unannounced, previously unannounced, will happen to ticket prices. Indeed, all ticket bookings will be honoured. What's going to happen is the service, probably towards the end of the year, will be put into the ownership of a public company for a further 12 months.
And as we know, there isn't any extra billions hidden down the back of the sock drawer. The government's got no money. I mean, do we know the extent of the government's hole in its transport budget now?
Alistair Darling has made it pretty clear that public spending is going to be constrained beyond 2011. What we understand is that at a conference earlier this year, the DfT officials said that the capital expenditure program at the Department for Transport, i.e. things that are to be built, such as, frankly, new rail schemes and high-speed rail and new roads, is not going to increase by the amount that we thought it would over the next 10 years. In fact, according to two calculations that I've seen, this increase is going to be £30 billion less than we thought.
Dan Milmo, well, plenty of you have been voicing your opinions about this. On Comment is Free, here's a selection.
Oh, for those good old days of British Rail. Dirty, rude, inefficient, but at least you knew who to blame.
This isn't just driving people into their cars, but also into aeroplanes for the longer distances.
When it all goes pear-shaped, we end up bailing them out anyway. We need a nationalised transport system with all the profits pumped back into the business and not into shareholders' pockets.
Can we not just ask the French to run our railways?
And there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/transport. Also on The Guardian's website today, Henry Porter, Guy Herbert and Chris Grayling all discuss the government's latest moves on ID cards. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. Alice Xin Liu looks at whether China's hopes of introducing green dam censorship software have been scuppered. That's at guardian.co.uk/china. And Poorna Shetty on the Indian government, which is considering decriminalising homosexuality. guardian.co.uk/India. The former Prime Minister Tony Blair's hopes of becoming Europe's first president have become more remote as Sweden takes over the rotating EU chair. But it's good news for the battle against global warming, as our Europe editor Ian Traynor reports.
Well, I'm in Stockholm here on the waterfront, a beautiful sunny day. Stockholm boasts being the greenest city in Europe. So the Swedes obviously set great store by their contribution to reducing global warming and fighting climate change. And of course, their 6 months presidency of the EU coincides with the run-up to the major international conference in December in Copenhagen on the successor to the Kyoto Protocol. So this is the absolutely crucial global meeting on what the world is going to be doing to tackle climate change, and the Swedes have all that on their plate, getting the EU's act together for that deal in December.
And a completely different approach towards climate change from Sweden to that we saw from the Czech Republic.
Well, of course, from the greenest city in Europe, allegedly, to the biggest climate change denier in Europe, namely President Václav Klaus in Prague. Having said that, of course, the Czechs themselves, the government, was running the show and not Klaus. And they did, to a degree, push forward the climate change agenda. But one does expect a much more vigorous effort from the Conservative Swedish government.
Now, how do the new EU president, Sweden, how do they view the hopes of those who would want Tony Blair to become the next EU president?
Basically, everybody's waiting for the Irish to vote in the second referendum at the beginning of October. In Brussels speak, the Irish got it wrong the first time and they better get it right this time, i.e. vote for the Lisbon Treaty, which streamlines the way the European Union works and also creates the first sitting European president. Now, Tony Blair, although he has not formally declared his candidacy, is widely expected to do so if the Irish vote the right way, so to speak. His main asset is that there is not really any big alternative candidates, at least at the moment, who are surfacing or coming out of the woodwork. Everybody knows Tony Blair. He's a recognisable brand. He's a big name. He's got good international contacts and so on and so forth. The Swedes, however, have to be said that Mr. Reinfeldt has made it plain that the smaller countries in the EU are pretty worried about a Blair presidency, that they will be overshadowed by the former British Prime Minister, that the wishes of the smaller countries in an EU of 27 will be ignored in favour of the big four or five countries running things, namely Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and perhaps Spain or Poland. So there's obviously some quite strong resistance there. And what's more, following Sweden in the EU presidency is Spain. And Prime Minister Zapatero in Madrid is also believed to be less than keen on Tony Blair getting the job because it would kind of usurp his 6 months in the limelight.
Ian Traynor. My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, diners raise a glass to cheaper meals in French restaurants because of a cut in VAT. But first, the Shadow Chancellor George Osborne has claimed that Gordon Brown refused to let him see data on government spending. But the Business Secretary, Lord Mandelson, says that was a deliberate untruth. Nicholas Watt, our chief political correspondent, is in Westminster. He says the row over public spending is getting pretty nasty.
Well, it's rumbling on. This is the third week in a row that the spending row has dominated Prime Minister's questions. And you would have thought that Downing Street would be thinking that if this has been going on for 3 weeks, perhaps they need to wonder whether their strategy is altogether a perfect one. Obviously, the Prime Minister had a bit of a bungle when he said that spending would increase by 0%, which is rewriting the laws of mathematics.
Total spending will continue to rise, and it will be at 0% rise in 2013-14.
He then did a series of television interviews last night to correct that, and he said what I was actually saying was that current spending would increase by 0.7%. I didn't get the 0.7% bit in because my words were drowned up by the noisy scenes in the House of Commons. So he corrected that element, but what he's not doing is rethinking the overall strategy, and the overall strategy is to say that at the next general election, the voters will have a choice between what he calls Labour investment and Tory cuts. Now, that is a very, very difficult position to sustain when, if you take the overall envelope that he's outlined for the post-2011 period, you run the Treasury forecast of inflation through that, and you get an overall cut of that period of overall spending of 0.1%. So actually, the choice that will be facing voters at the next general election is not between Labour investment and Tory cuts. It's a choice between Labour cuts and Tory cuts.
And Prime Minister's questions was preceded yesterday with a rather entertaining, I suppose, in some ways, row between George Osborne, the Shadow Chancellor, and Lord Mandelson, the Business Secretary. Not the first time they've locked horns, of course.
Well, it seems that when the sun shines and the weather's a little warm, that Peter Mandelson and George Osborne lock horns. Of course, there was the great Yachtgate row of last summer, and now the sun is warm, not in Corfu, but the sun is warm in London, and they've had another spat. And at one level, this is quite entertaining, because it's a personal row, but at another level, it illustrates a serious political point. And what this all boils down to is that George Osborne says that as part of our preparations for government, if we win the next election, we would like to see all the facts and figures, all the Treasury figures of spending forecasts. It's a thing called the Coins Database that has extraordinary level of detail of spending. And George Osborne is saying that is being denied to us, and denied to us by the Prime Minister. Peter Mandelson came back and said, no, that's wrong on two counts. One, you haven't actually put in a request for this database. And if it were refused to you, it wouldn't be refused by the Prime Minister. It would be refused by the Cabinet Secretary. The Tories know that this is potentially damaging for them. So they, last night, were releasing some correspondence between them and various permanent secretaries in Whitehall, because, of course, they're in talks with them because we're in a pre-election period. And the Tories are showing that those correspondents show that they have made this request for this information.
Nick Watt in Westminster. Two environmental protesters are on trial accused of hijacking a coal train at Drax Power Station near Selby in North Yorkshire. Leeds University lecturer Paul Chatterton is leading the defence, and he told the court yesterday he acted because of passion and terror at the implications of coal-burning power stations for global warming. Martin Wainwright reports from Leeds Crown Court.
I've just come out of the court case in Leeds where 22 climate change protesters who are accused of hijacking and stopping a coal train taking supplies to Drax Power Station, the biggest coal-fired power station in Europe, are on trial for doing that. And it's been a really fascinating day today, which I suspect will have implications for British justice in the long term, because what we've seen has been the judge saying throughout the day, we're just here to decide whether or not you stop this train, guilty or not guilty. But the defendant saying, no, there's more to it than that. We were there, we did stop the train, but we had wider reasons for doing so. And they've spent the whole day trying to get that through to the jury, while the judge, and it's all been very good-natured, I should say, it's not been a hostile confrontation, but the judge has kept interrupting them and saying, you know, please stick to the train. And I'm with two parents of two of the defendants. First of all, Mike Russell. Mike, what's your feeling about what's gone on today? Do you think they've managed to get over a lot of what they hoped to do?
Yes, it's been an extraordinary day. I mean, it started off where the judge really wouldn't let them give any evidence other than things specific to do with the train. And he did, for various reasons we can't talk about, he did stop the trial a couple of times and sent the jury out. But since then, he seems to have allowed them, although he has sort of interjected several times and guided them back onto the kind of what he sees as being the right course, but he has allowed them to talk about climate change. He's allowed them to talk about all the issues that led them to go onto that train in the first place.
Because we've had some quite almost moving moments, haven't we, where one of the Alison, or Beth, she calls herself, Stratford, was allowed to show the jury pictures of her hometown Louth in Lincolnshire, partially underwater in the floods. And she says that's the moment when she thought something's got to be done about this, linking the floods to climate change. And she was describing how her little nephew had said, don't worry, we can fix it. And that made her think, well, you know, I've got to do everything I can to fix it.
People have come up with all sorts of reasons. People have come up with science, people who have studied this. They've come up with a lot of reasons why they're on this train. And one of the last defendants made a very good point, which is there is, in English justice, a separation between judge and jury. And what he's saying is, I want the jury to judge us on this, not the judge. I want the jury to judge us on whether they find us guilty.
Good. I've also got Robin White with me, who's the father of another of the defendants. And Robin, you were just chatting a moment ago about that there are lustrous historical precedents for this, I think.
I think this is a really important moment where the climate change issue is transformed into personal journeys of young people who are not gangsters. This is not a great train robbery. These are people who have thought very long and hard about taking a very big step, risking their lives. So I may not agree with everything my son has done, but I've changed my mind today.
Martin Wainwright reporting. Now, a quick mention that you can follow Guardian Daily, find out what we're up to at twitter.com/Guardian Daily. Good news for those of you taking holidays in France this year. Value-added tax has been slashed from 19.6% to 5.5%. The French government hopes to boost consumer spending and create thousands of jobs. The Guardian's Angelique Chrysaphis had a taste of the reaction at an eatery in Paris.
My name is Marc-Antoine Lorne. and I'm working just around here in a PR office. Well, I eat every day in a restaurant. It has been a long battle for all the restaurants in France. And as far as I'm concerning, that is to say as a consumer, I'm just waiting for a price lower. And I hope this new law is going to create employment. I think it's a good idea if it's going to be followed by the restaurants, because everybody knows this is a very difficult job, because all these workers have a very long days of work, about very often 10 hours, you know. They are not so much paid. So, are they going to lower the price, or are they going to get this new VIT as more benefits? We don't know yet.
On July the 20th, 1969, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first humans to land on the moon. Magnificent desolation was how Aldrin described it. We all know what Armstrong said. And it was one of the most astonishing events in human history. And it's no less astonishing 40 years later. Chris Riley is a space historian, the author of the Apollo 11 Owner's Workshop Manual.
If you look back at the last sort of 50 years, so back before Apollo 11, of our search for extraterrestrial intelligence, in the galaxy, you know, listening out for signals, we can pretty much say that technological life is probably quite rare in the Milky Way and in our galaxy, and therefore the number of times that life has left one planet and gone to another is probably also very rare too. So I would say that Apollo 11 was something of galactic significance, and that's very rare that human beings do anything of galactic significance.
It did come out of quite special circumstances, didn't it? President Kennedy making the pledge to send a mission to the moon in 1961, and a lot of people, including NASA scientists, didn't really believe it could be done.
No, I mean, it was bordering on impossible, I think, back in 61 when it was laid down. And that was partly the reason why Kennedy made that announcement, because it was going to tax the Russians as much as it was going to tax the Americans. At the time, the Russians had the lead in terms of the power of their rockets and the weight of things that they could put up into space. They were way ahead of America. But America had one sort of card up its sleeve, if you like, and that was that they were much better at navigation in terms of potentially navigating to the moon. The thing about going to the moon was that it was a challenge about hitting a moving target. The moon's going around us pretty fast, you know, we're moving through space as well. You've got a totally different coordinate system than you have on Earth in terms of navigating between a couple of cities on the surface. And America was quite good at that. And so that's why Kennedy challenged Russia and America to this race back in 61.
Enormous drama. I mean, it didn't go completely smoothly, did it, the mission?
Well, all of these missions that they flew to the moon, and of course, Apollo 11 was the third flight there, test flight there, the first one to attempt a landing. They were all right out on the edge, right off beyond, you know, the envelope, if you like. And so, of course, things went wrong. And of course, things went wrong at tense and stressful times. There's about a 12-minute descent from being in orbit around the moon to landing. It's 12 minutes, and it was the 12 most nail-biting minutes of the whole mission. Two things went wrong, really. The computer got overloaded due to an error in flight procedures, and they got low on fuel because they were running long. They realised that very fast. They were being taken into a very rough area, and they had to overfly it and manually kind of land in another place, and that took up more fuel.
One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Okay, Neil Armstrong fluffed the line, but fine words. But what did it really do for mankind?
Well, I think the legacy, the gift of Apollo, if you like, is manifold, of course. There's technological spin-offs, some 30,000 things in use these days that came out of Apollo, of course. But there's something bigger and broader about it, I think, that's worth celebrating today. And that is the spiritual gifts of Apollo, if you like. Somebody said that on the way to the moon, we discovered the Earth. These views of the Earth looking back from 250,000 miles away were really profound, and they did something really deep and important in society and in our communities. And it turned a lot of people to realizing that the Earth's pretty fragile and vulnerable. And that, of course, we're still living through the legacy of today.
Chris Riley, and today The Guardian publishes a special edition of G2 focusing on the moon landings. Read it online at guardian.co.uk/space. And next week's Science Weekly podcast contains a longer interview with Chris Riley. Don't forget to listen to that at guardian.co.uk/audio. Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's show. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.